The following program has been provided by the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project. For more information, call 1-800-735-0230 or log on to pacificaradioarchives.org.
This is an interview with Arthur Clarke, the distinguished science writer and many other things, very much the Renaissance man, who is here, I understand, in San Francisco today in connection with the newly released major motion picture 2001, A Space Odyssey, which has very recently been released and is now due for its San Francisco premiere. Are there any particular remarks, Arthur, that you would think the radio audience would be especially interested in connection with this picture?
Well, it's the first, of course, really major film on science fiction. There have been many science fiction films in the past. Most of them are the low-budget affairs, and very few of them any good indeed, though there have been some, I think, very fine efforts. But this is the first Cinerama movie in this area, and of course the theme of space travel is uniquely suited for the screen. It's a very big budget movie. It cost more than $10 million, partly because of the extraordinary detailed special effects, which are quite unprecedented. Everybody who's remarked about the movie said some of the effects are unbelievable, and that's why it took 4 years to do. Nevertheless, the special effects and the spacecraft, all the different types of space stations and space vehicles, are only the background for the theme of the film, which is man and the universe, or if you like, man and God, and that's the interpretation many people have put on it.
Although I have not yet myself had the pleasure of seeing this film, I've talked with a number of science fiction people, including old-time science fiction writers who have seen it, and they are all utterly delighted and amazed at seeing what they've been writing about all these years.
You know, one of my fears is that space will turn out to be not as beautiful and as entrancing as some of the scenes in the movie, which is...
That is very possible, or a picture, say, by our local astronomical artist, Chesley Bonestell. We might conceivably be a little disappointed. On the other hand, as you have pointed out in your works, we're much more likely to be surprised and to find things we never dreamed were there.
This is true. In fact, the universe always turns out to be infinitely surprising. And in fact, I'm always fond of quoting Haldane, a remark that Professor J.B.S. Haldane once made, that the universe is not only stranger than we imagine, it is stranger than we can imagine.
As the various probes are just beginning to show to us, I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, no science fiction writer, not even yourself, predicted the craters on Mars, for example, although Clyde Tombaugh, I believe, did a number of years ago.
That is true, and the moon, too, is turning to be full of surprises, although, of course, many of the things we expected to find on the moon have turned out to be precisely that. For example, we've always been saying that the lunar soil is going to be much made of the same materials as the Earth, and this has proved to be precisely the case. But until quite recently, of course, we were worried about whether there were large areas of dust in which we might sink, and we now know this is not the case.
Which, however, I might add, does not make your novel about it, A Fall of Moon Dust, less enjoyable. And incidentally, I have heard it suggested that this might be the case on Mars after all these
processes. This is a possibility. The Fall of Moon Dust has been perhaps my most successful novel financially, and that would make a very good movie. So I can solve this situation by moving it to Mars and saying, well, we can't prove there's no dust on Mars, even though we're fairly sure there's no dust on the moon.
Well, as I understand it, the suggestion has been made that while lunar dust would undergo vacuum welding into a solid matrix, there might be just enough atmosphere on Mars to prevent this from happening.
Yes, fine. So it's probably a more appropriate place for this.
One thing that you have always emphasize more in your writing than most other, in fact virtually any other publicizer or popularizer, or what you wish to say,
a French of a good word, vulgar, vulgarizer, vulgarization.
Yes, of astronautics has been what you were also mentioning this new film of yours is developing. That is to say, you might say the aesthetic, social, even spiritual values to be found out there in experiencing new environments, the possible broadening of the human spirit that may come from this.
Well, this is primarily the theme of this movie, and which is one of the things that's caused so much controversy and surprise and sometimes shocked and puzzled a few people who are not used to thinking in these terms. The theme of the movie is really man's place in the hierarchy of the universe. Where are we in the pecking order, which extends all the way from apes to angels and perhaps beyond? And it begins with the apes, or rather they are ape-like ancestors, the man-apes in Africa, 4 million years ago, with the first encounter between Earth life and some form of extraterrestrial intelligence, which even at that level has probably gone beyond our present ideas of life and is already sort of, you know, far in advance. And the implication is this gives us a kind of evolutionary nudge 4 million years ago, which in fact leads to us now. And then in the year 2001, when the movie, the next stage of the movie, shows us catching up with this force or this power again.
They have endured that long then? They're still ready to receive us?
Well, we don't say whether it's a they or an it. And presumably a really advanced civilization, or even a really advanced entity or intelligence, would probably be immortal. And 4 million years is only a moment in the history of the universe.
Yes, I remember, again, in your own writings, having frequently touched on this, various ways to achieve physical immortality, or at least, let's say, an indefinitely long lifespan. And you remark particularly that to a being, or even a future human who had this gift, the enormous distances between the stars might not seem so very long after all.
You quite
afford the time.
Quite, in fact. Even to human beings, you know, if you can ever reach velocities near the speed of light, which are certainly theoretically possible, a journey to the nearer stars is only the order of a decade. Now, with hibernation, sort of suspension of life processes, which is again something which is probably feasible, this does mean that men could go to the nearer stars and back in one lifetime if they wanted to. However, going beyond that, I am now no longer so sure that the speed of light is a limiting barrier, and there's been some really interesting studies recently. In fact, the first attempts have been made to detect particles traveling faster than light, and there's some theoretical reasons for thinking that they might exist. And if this is the case, then, you know, the walls may be down.
Yes, I've read about that. It's quite fascinating. As I understand it, the idea is that while the speed of light itself remains unattainable, it might also be unattainable from the other side.
Precisely.
There might be particles which cannot go that slow.
You see, the theory of relativity doesn't say you can go faster than you cannot go faster than light. It merely says you cannot go at the speed of light.
Right.
It's what the mathematicians call a discontinuity, and physics is full of such things. And there might be particles which could never travel slower than the speed of light.
Now, my own thought on this was that if you can detect them at all, then in some way there must be some kind of interaction possible.
Yes.
With them. In that case, theoretically, you can modulate them, and theoretically, if you can send a signal,
right,
you can do anything.
Quite, and perhaps even send yourself, or
yes,
at least. We must keep an open mind on this subject. Nevertheless, even if we are limited by the speed of light, which is certainly the more probable assumption, we can still explore a great deal of the universe. And either by suspended animation, or by perhaps if we can reach near the speed of light, our old friend, the relativity time dilation effect, which you have used often, as we all have, in our stories, and can go around the universe. And even if we cannot travel, then we can certainly communicate.
It has been suggested, well, for example, when the AAAS met here in Berkeley a few years ago, there was an all-day symposium on interstellar communication, and it was agreed that there's no use our trying to keep radio silence.
It's too late.
Yes, if anybody's listening within a number of light years, they've picked us up, and at which point someone, I believe it was Carl Sagan, said there's a certain horror in the concept of the Beverly Hillbillies expanding spherically at the speed of light through the universe.
This is true, but luckily I think that most of our ordinary communications and network radio and TV will have sunk far below the threshold of noise, probably before it reaches the limits of the solar system. It's only the high-powered radars that could probably be detected over interstellar distances.
Yes. I mean, actually, he was being fairly facetious, of
as
course.
As Carl is.
although you undoubtedly know more about this than I do, I did, however, hear quite a fascinating talk by Dr. Bernard Oliver explaining his basic design for a new type of radio telescope, according to which he felt it would be possible to detect something like the MIT Haystack antenna as far out as 15,000 light years.
Well, it depends on the rate of signaling you're prepared to accept, and on a lot of assumptions. The main one is that you know exactly what the other guy is doing in the first place, and then you can cooperate. But if you're making a random search for a signal, you don't even know the signal is there, what wavelength it's on, then you have to have much greater powers. And this is where this these fantastic radio signals, emissions or other, that have been detected in the last few months are so fascinating, because it looks as though this may be an attempt at communication. We can't find any natural explanation yet for these very rhythmic pulses from the so-called pulsars.
Oh yes, I've been reading about that. Well, there are, as you know, some alternative explanations.
They've all been shot down, as far as I know, at the moment.
Yes, well, and to me at least, some of these pulsating neutron stars and so on are, if anything, somewhat more fantastic than the idea of someone out there just trying to send a beacon.
Absolutely, the idea of a sun only 10 miles in diameter, weighing as much as our sun with a gravitational field of a few million or whatever it is, and then pulsing with this incredibly pulsing more accurately than any normal, even electronic timekeeper. I find this more incredible than an artificial source of radiation, which is the sort of thing one would expect and one has in fact been looking for. Incidentally, some of the arguments against these things being artificial have struck me as being very, very feeble. For example, it's been said, well, we have found several of these things now, not just one, and therefore they're probably a natural phenomenon. Well, there are several radio stations on Earth.
And at this point, I should remind the audience that these topics and many more are discussed in Arthur Clarke's forthcoming new book, The Promise of Space, out from Harper and Row, did you say next month?
Yes, it comes out early in June, and the Book of the Month Club are doing their edition later this summer, so it'll probably have the widest circulation of any space book since I did The Exploration of Space back in 1952, which incidentally brought me to San Francisco for my first visit.
Oh, I have the book here on my lap, as I said. A very handsome volume physically, and the typical eclectic Arthur Clarke range, beginning with imaginary voyages, early science fiction, and so on, and continuing through what has been done already, what will be done in the near future, and eventually what might be done. The part 5, in fact, is entitled Around the Universe. And again, these philosophical problems are discussed. I think anybody who is at all interested in these matters, and everybody should be, because this is where it's at, will want to read this book. By the way, Arthur, I notice the Russians are thinking along much the same lines, not only in the near future themselves, but they've published some very imaginative stuff about what man might do even in the very far future.
Yes, the Russians have always been very interested in science fiction and, of course, in space travel as such. The first serious studies of space flight were made by the Russian pioneer Tsiolkovsky, and he derived the equations of space flight not in this century, but in the closing decade of the last century, and he published his results the same year that the Wright brothers flew, and this is why the Russians have such an interest in the subject. And as you also probably know, the Russian space effort now is running at about twice the level of the American space effort. And I'm afraid this country is going to be Sputnik all over again. You know, they say that people don't learn from history, and it looks as though it's going to happen.
What, if I might ask, are your next plans, having finished the film, finished the book? You're surely going to be going on to something else.
Well, after 4 years' work on the movie, which has sort of blocked any other kind of work, although I did write this Promise of Space during a brief 3 months visit back to Ceylon last year, there are so many things that had to be swept under the carpet, and many short story ideas I have. I'm going to take a long rest, I hope, first. Then I want to start writing short stories again, and I have provisionally decided to do no more non-fiction. I'm sure this is a resolution I shall break, but I want to concentrate on fiction, and specifically on short stories, which are my favorite medium.
Well, this would be remain mostly within the science fiction field?
Oh, entirely. I don't know quite why, but I'm simply not interested in anything that is not science fiction. I suspect for this reason, because science fiction is concerned with reality, and most fiction is concerned with trivial bits of reality, such as the interactions of one biological species on an obscure planet in a very out-of-the-way part of the galaxy. I like to speculate about the real universe.
It is not at the moment a view very fashionable with the literary critics, is it?
Well, the literary critics have been pretty thoroughly clobbered as a result of many things, including, I might say, 2001, which has made the establishment sit up and take notice. They're realizing, in fact, you know, this is the real thing. This is the name of the game. And it's been fascinating to study some of the contortions of the people who haven't realized what this is all about and that, in fact, have tried to dismiss it.
I was just looking at a full-page, you might say, essay rather than review from the Christian Science Monitor, which takes the film very seriously indeed.
Well, everybody is doing so now, in fact. We have had not only the most tremendous reviews, but articles about the film written by people, some of them reviewers who've gone back again and had second thoughts and, you know, developed it further. It's creating perhaps more controversy than any movie I can think of. I used to have great fun standing outside the Broadway theater and listening to the crowd, the people that are coming out, that are arguing all the way down Broadway. And I know one science fiction convention, incidentally, which at least one person had to be thrown out bodily in the discussion about 2001.
I imagine these arguments are more along the what you might call philosophical implications than just the technology.
Yes, because the technology is something which is, you know, presented in clear and fairly clear cut, and it is based on what we know about space. It's an considerable extrapolation of existing ideas, but it's all fairly comprehensible. Whereas the ending of the movie, where we get into metaphysics, if you like, and certainly philosophical and religious thoughts, this is where the controversy arises. Now, these ideas which are presented, Stanley Kubrick and I had a completely logical structure in mind. And this, you know, we worked out very carefully. And at one time we thought there'd be a lot of narration to perhaps underline these things. But as Stanley put together the visual images, and he realized that not only did we not need any narration, but in fact that would have been a disaster, because we are now communicating with a generation which grasp these ideas visually with such speed that they words, you know, we just hold them up. In fact, this seems to disprove some of Marsha McLuhan's theses.
Wouldn't the McLuhanites, if anything,
or McLuhanitics,
say,
I call
it. Yeah. Might they not maintain that, on the contrary, this represents the further decline of the written word?
Well, they could, they might. Well, let's see what they say about the novel, in which all these ideas are explicated.
You are doing a novel?
Well, we wrote the novel before the screenplay.
Oh,
the
I
two,
see.
Well, not before exactly. The two were done simultaneously. Sometimes one was ahead of the other. It was Stanley's idea that I write a novel, because in the process of writing the novel, all sorts of new ideas would be generated, and we would have much greater depth and solidity to the project.
Oh, I see.
The novel, 2001, will be out, in fact, this month from New American Library.
Oh, very good. And that tells essentially the same story
as
the film?
Yes, the storyline is identical, apart from one or two little changes where there were better visual ways of doing one thing and other ways, better verbal ways.
I see.
But, and of course, a novel, which is it can go into very much more detail about many things, and particularly philosophical and metaphysical ideas.
That should make quite a fascinating comparison.
I'm sure there'll be a lot of PhD theses being sort of ground out over this in the years to come. Incidentally, one of the interesting things is this that's come out of the film. Because we did not underline and give explanations of all the things that happen at the end of the movie, people are getting their own interpretations, many of which are things we never thought of, but which at the same time are completely valid. We had deliberately set out to construct a myth of the space age, if you like. This was the only way of tackling the problem of representing the reactions of an infinitely superior intelligence. We couldn't show it, you know, in literal, exact terms, because obviously we couldn't understand this. So we had to do many things sort of visually, say, by suggestion and by emotions and so forth. And as a result, there's a great deal of what I call constructive ambiguity about many of the scenes. And so people are producing their own interpretations.
You might... would you feel that these... you might as well call them science fiction concepts, are to some extent then an emerging mythology more suited to our age than the older ones?
In many ways, yet at the same time, they are based on earlier myths, because there's an archetypal element in all myths. In fact, we chose the title deliberately, A Space Odyssey, and we were conscious of the parallel with Odysseus, and as in any Odyssey, he comes back to Earth eventually, but he comes back totally transformed into the next order of evolution.
I see. So you would feel then that essentially we stay with the same archetypes, the same myths always, but give them new forms depending on present conditions?
Well, I hope we can invent new myths, because after all, someone invented these myths once, and maybe we ought to be able to go a little further. But I think they'll always have validity as long as human beings are remotely human.
It has been suggested that human nature, whatever that means, man's ways of thinking at least, as well as his ways of everyday life, may to some extent be a function of the technology he happens to have at the present time. Would you agree to that?
Well, this is, I guess, inevitable. And technology means tools. And the 2001 opens with the first tool. In fact, we begin with our ancestors, suggesting that they were programmed, or at least directed, to use the first tools, which were the first weapons. The first tool was a club with which you clobbered your neighbor, you see. And this is shown in a very poetic and extraordinarily impressive way in the opening sequence of the movie, which is called The Dawn of Man. And I think this itself is going to be one of the great classics of the movies. So we do show how technology affects man and his behavior. And it's, again, a chicken or the egg kind of thing. You can't separate one from the other.
Yes, I have noticed that in most of your writing certainly in this film here, you are predicting that men are assuming, supposing it possible, that man is capable of more or less staying on top of his technology and not knocking himself back down with it.
Well, here again, we've got a certain ambiguity, because some people have taken exactly the reverse view as a result of seeing this movie. And this is fine. This is what we want them. We want them to people to think, and not necessarily to think the same the way that we do. Let me be specific. You see, one of the main characters in the movie, as I think most people know now, is the computer HAL, HAL 9000, who tries to take over the ship. And he has, I might say, very good reasons for doing this, which are made quite clear in the novel, which we couldn't go into in detail in the movie. Now, some people say that this shows that our machines are superseding us, yet at the same time, HAL is eventually frustrated by the human beings in one way. But it's a kind of Pyrrhic victory, and you can still make many interpretations of what happens.
And you would not, feel reasonably sure that you would not go along with what so many people still seem to feel, that technology, particularly the very pervasive technology we are getting today, is dehumanizing us.
No, I think it's superhumanizing us.
Ah.
In fact, I've always thought, and this idea I've worked at in quite a number of my scientific essays as well as in fiction, so the next stage in evolution may be electronic, or if you like, mechanical, and the organic entities such as us represent an intermediate stage, and we may be superseded by the ultra-intelligent machines, and they in turn may be superseded by perhaps pure energy or spirit. And this again is one of the implications, a possible implication of 2001.
Do you think that when this possibility arose, man, considering he's always been a pretty rambunctious creature, would agree to be superseded?
I don't think he'd have much choice, and it might be a difficult and unpleasant period, but I'm sure that the Cro-Magnon men, or rather let's say the Neanderthalers, were very unhappy about being superseded by the Cro-Magnon men, if indeed they were contemporary. But they couldn't do much about it either.
This has, at least since the original novel Frankenstein, this, and probably further back than that, this has been a sort of recurring literary nightmare. But
really, the Faust legend, isn't it?
Yes.
The earliest
mm-hmm.
one, I think. Knowledge.
Might it not be possible, though, especially with the advances now being made in experimental genetics, that man might improve himself, perhaps, say, in partnership with his machines?
Well, human genetics is a very slow process, whereas, a human generation takes 20 years, whereas a computer generation takes 2 or 3 years. So, and moreover, the computers are potentially so much swifter and so much more flexible that I don't think there'll be much of a contest.
I see. And you feel then that there is perhaps being too much made of the potentialities of the present work in DNA and RNA?
Oh no, that's of enormous importance to us as human beings. All I'm saying is that human beings may not be of all that importance to the universe.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, turning back a little closer to the present period, I have noticed in your writings, as I was saying, that you normally seem to assume a reasonably peaceful and well-behaved near future, international cooperation in space and so on, or would you feel that perhaps this would come about out of sheer necessity, that there is no longer any alternative?
I think so. I've always been preaching cooperation in space, and I've been fairly active in it. I was chairman of the first international conference in London of the various astronautical societies, and as chairman of the British Interplanetary Society, I've been very active in this kind of thing. And I am happy to see the amount of cooperation that does exist, which is more than most people imagine. It was exemplified best in the United Nations Treaty on the peaceful uses of outer space only last year. And I'm sure that we will have eventually, you know, a very large degree of cooperation in space. We will be forced upon us, just as it is in the Antarctic.
Would this necessarily imply a similar degree of cooperation on Earth? After all, there was always a good bit of cooperation on the high seas, which didn't prevent some fairly bloody events on land.
True, this is correct. And you have an extraordinary situation now, of course, where you have American and Russian scientists working very happily together as close personal friends, whereas the CIA and their opposite number are getting at each other, and perhaps it may be in the next room for all you can tell. But one reason why I write the sort of optimistic kind of science fiction, and why I've written practically nothing on, I never write about interplanetary wars and so forth, even though they're, you know, more exciting, and is that I hope that by doing this I can help to bring about what's been called a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, may give a little nudge to push events in this direction.
Incidentally, another type of very interesting development you've been predicting for some time is the intensive and extensive use of the seas, especially as a source for food and other materials.
Yes, as a result of my interest in skin diving, I have written quite a bit about the sea, both fiction and non-fiction, and specifically on cetaceans, whales and dolphins. I did a novel about whale ranching called The Deep Range, which I think might make a very interesting film if anyone can get around the technical difficulties. Having seen what Stanley Kubrick did on 2001, I realized now anything that can be described can be filmed. The sea is the other great frontier of the future, and in the near future, it may be more important than space. We'll get from it food, minerals, and perhaps the most important commodity of all, fresh water.
Oh, yes. You mean with
desalination.
Quite. Yes. Incidentally, the deep range ends to some extent on a philosophical or even religious note when man gradually comes to realize that the Cetaceans are beings too intelligent and sensitive to be exploitable. That is to say, man hasn't the right. And I was wondering what your opinion is of this, you know, in all seriousness,
yes.
Is of this possibility as regards the dolphins.
Well, I've been fascinated by this subject, as I think nearly everybody is. And I did in Dolphin Island. I tried to describe, you know, discovery of communication with dolphins. But I'm a little disappointed with the slow progress in this field. And although dolphins are certainly delightful and intelligent, and perhaps much nicer than human beings, I'm becoming rather skeptical of their intelligence for a rather obvious reason. They seem much too friendly to man.
Yes, and of course it always was a little problematic what use anything we would recognize as a high degree of intelligence comparable to ours would be to a creature that has no hands or anything similar.
But they do have very large brains, and those brains do seem to be very complex, but that may be mostly concerned with the handling of vast amounts of information as they try to navigate through their, you know, rather opaque medium, and use sonar and other senses, which are perhaps not as efficient as vision, and therefore they have to have all this processing mechanism. They needn't necessarily be very intelligent.
Yes, that, as far as I've been able to find out, it's been shown that, beyond much doubt, that they are brighter than, say, dogs or cats, but perhaps comparable to apes, but that's about all that's been shown.
Yeah. That's all of it that's been demonstrated. However, there may be some surprises here.
It has been suggested, of course, and this would get us back to the possibility of communication with beings from other planets even, that the dolphins may have an intelligence which is so different in kind from ours that we can't recognize it as such.
Well, in that case, one would say, well, it's best a matter of definition. So is it intelligence? Because intelligence is what we are. Of course, it's a very self-centered point of view. But how can one adopt any other?
This has been an extremely interesting interview. I wonder if you would mind wrapping it up with something I think is very typical, both of your own activities, of everything you stand for and have been explaining to people. You'll recall at the banquet of the World Science Fiction Convention in London, you stood up with a small object in each hand and told us what they were. Or perhaps you would like to tell the audience what you were holding that day.
Yes, I had two artifacts, which I think gave some idea of the speed of technological development. There was less than 200 years between them. One was a copper nail from the Bounty, which was found off Pitcairn Island, given to me by Lewis Marden of the National Geographic Society. And the other was a bit of the heat shield from the Apollo spacecraft. And so these are, if you like, from two of the most famous vessels in the history of mankind, the Bounty and the first ship that's going to go to the moon. Or conceivably the second ship that's going to go to the moon. And yet there's only 200 years between them, but they represent a technological gulf which is almost immeasurable. And so imagine what we're going to be doing in another 200 years and what must have been done out in the universe in the millions of years that lie behind.
And certainly your film 2001, companion novel, and your forthcoming book, The Promise of Space, will give us as good an intimation of what this may be as can be found anywhere.
I hope so.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.